left, but this $36 million settlement comes on top of $20 million that New York State agreed to pay. Why was, we can see the FBI, the federal government, the New York City police, but why, what was the culpability of the state in all of this?
So,
thank you. Go ahead, Dave.
Oh, sorry, Abdurrahman. Yeah, just to clarify that one, the total between the city and state is $36 million. So it was $26 million from the city and $10 million from the state that came previously. And the reason the state paid is because New York State is one of few states in the country that has a law that compensates people who are wrongfully convicted and imprisoned. And that's a major movement of, you know, my partners at the Innocence Project and other organizations to get similar laws passed in the rest of the country.
Well, we want to thank you both for being with us. David Shaness, civil rights and wrongful conviction lawyer who represented Muhammad Aziz and the family of Khalil Islam. And thank you to Abdurrahman Muhammad, independent scholar, historian, journalist and activist who helped break open this case, didn't let it go for decades. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Currently accepting applications for a video news production fellowship and a people and culture manager. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
This is KBOO Portland.
This program is made possible by KBOO members and support from the League of Women Voters of Portland, providing nonpartisan election information at lwvpdx.org. The League of Women Voters has online voters' guides, videos, and podcasts to help voters understand the state and local candidates and measures that will be on the ballot this November. Nonpartisan voter information is at lwvpdx.org.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 8 a.m. It's Tuesday. It's time for Too Much Information with your hosts, Tracy Simmons and Abe Proctor. Stay tuned.
All right. Good morning. Good morning. Welcome to Too Much Information on KBOO 90.7 FM. The number to call, 503-231-8187. There's a lot going on this week. Very interested to hear your take. My name is Abe Crocker. Joining me, as she does each and every week, the illustrious Tracy Simmons. Good morning, Tracy.
Good morning, Abe. Good morning, listeners.
Tracy, so crazy stuff happening.
Like crazy. I mean, hopefully it turns out to be good, crazy. But if anyone's been paying attention to the international news, many people are aware that the Brazilian president, Bolsonaro, has effectively lost his re-election to the leftist Lula, who has been a leftist leader in Brazil for many years, was the former president. Of course, at some point was convicted on corruption charges, served about 580 days in prison for that, emerged, and was those charges were annulled and ran against the incumbent, Bolsonaro, and has won that election. And so, you know, I think what we should do today is talk about not only what this means for democracy in Brazil, but what it means for the rest of us in the world that are fighting to save democracy and pushing against far-right authoritarianism.
That's exactly what we're going to do, and we're interested in hearing your thoughts on these many overlapping subjects. Overlapping, he said. Yes, he did. We're talking about the pushback against right-wing authoritarianism. And you've probably heard a lot of variations of this argument being thrown out over the last couple of years, that around the world there seems to be many different nations living in a state of tension between a more liberalized, open and free society and a more closed authoritarian right-wing society. You can point at many nations in, across Europe to illustrate this trend. And up until fairly recently, you could point to many nations in Latin America as parts of this trend. But as we're going to discuss this morning, there has been a broad pushback in Central and South America against right-wing authoritarian leadership, especially amongst the larger nations. This began in 2010 with the election of Andrés Manuel López Obrador in Mexico, and it has continued. Leftist leaders have been swept into office in Chile, in Colombia, in Peru, in Argentina, and now, of course, in Brazil, the largest economy in Latin America. All of these elections represent a rejection of this trend towards authoritarianism. This is probably best illustrated, as Tracy mentioned, by the departing President Bolsonaro in Brazil, who made worldwide headlines for his aggressive extraction of resources from the Amazon basin, and in more recent times, his attempts to rig the electoral system in Brazil to preserve his place in power. And he was ousted by a returning president, Lula, who actually spent some time in prison during Obrador's reign, which gives you some idea of just what the Brazilians have been dealing with. So if we look north, though, we see a center-left government in Canada, although we have to add a caveat there. This is a center-left prime minister in a parliamentary system, which means that they are functionally and ideologically, it must be said, to the left of the center-left ruling party here in the United States, which at the moment is the Democratic Party. And I think we spilled a lot of wind on this program talking about the Democratic Party, Tracy, particularly in recent weeks. So the question is, can the northern part of the Americas keep this trend going and take a decisive step away from right-wing authoritarian policies and personages? It remains to be seen. But events in southern climes, Tracy, give us reason to hope.
I mean, I am always going to be hopeful because that's just how I show up in the world. And, you know, I think if we lose hope, we lose any motivation to change, right? And so I think there are forces, of course, at work here and in other countries, really trying to dampen folks' hope, right? And I think about, you know, polling and how polling is done and how polling gets an outsized, you know, kind of energy around like, ooh, this is where, you know, this is what the polls say, right? And so that has a dampening effect on you know, voters. It's a voter suppressive kind of energy. That we also have to be thinking about when we are having these conversations. But, you know, when I talk about, like, on the global perspective of fighting authoritarianism, unfortunately, not every country that's been faced with these decisions has successfully defended democracy. So in 2022, Italy elected a far-right prime minister from a party with fascist roots. And the party itself was founded by neo-Nazis and skinheads in Sweden's, so a high number of seats in Sweden's parliament. Of course, Hungary, right, has Viktor Orban, and that party is definitely aligned with far-right authoritarianism and anti-Semitism, as well as Marine Le Pen, who won 41% of the vote in France's presidential elections. And so, you know, what we're seeing is this global rise of authoritarianism that not everyone is able to effectively beat back. And even thinking about the Bolsonaro loss, it's very close. It's very close. And similar to, you know, the former guy, he has not conceded the race as of yet. So we'll see what happens in that space. But, you know, as we were talking about it last week, right, there are literal election deniers from the 2020 election who are running in the United States in this 2022 midterms who have already said they don't accept the results of the 2020 election. And if they don't win, they won't accept the results of the 2022 election. It's very, very dangerous for democracy. And I think, you know, as we continue to kind of fight against media narratives that paint, you know, two sides of the electoral coin as the same, we have to say, no, this is really dangerous. These people cannot be in charge. They cannot be at the policymaking table. And furthermore, right, the future of civil rights, the future of, you know, the rights of all Americans are in jeopardy, in peril, if we don't take these statements seriously. And, you know, just tying in just a little bit, you know, we heard about the attack on Nancy Pelosi's husband. And once again, what I will say about the authoritarian right is they will pick their people as targets, and that stochastic violence does turn out to have real life impacts on people. And so it's all of a piece, and I think to make those connections is really important in this space.
Absolutely true. Yeah, these connections are happening all over the place. You mentioned the horrific attack on Nancy Pelosi's husband. For those of you who haven't been paying attention, a man broke into their home in San Francisco. The speaker was away. Notably, when she is at home, there's significant security in the Pelosi's house, as she is the Speaker of the House and she travels with a permanent security detail. She was away, and that security presence was not there at the time this break-in occurred. So a 42-year-old white man broke into the Pelosi's house and assaulted Paul Pelosi, Nancy Pelosi's husband, with a hammer, fracturing his skull and sending him to the hospital, very nearly killing him. So cue the responses from the authoritarian right wing in this country. There was all across the board responses ranging everywhere from complete denial of the event to a wacky conspiracy theory claiming that the assailant was a bearded hippie nudist from Berkeley. All over the map. Really anything but any sort of admission that the wildly unhinged and violent rhetoric coming out of the right had anything to do with this attack. But of course, this fits a pattern that has become so familiar to us by now that it's really hard to conclude that the attack had anything it's hard to conclude it was anything but related to the rhetoric that's been coming out of the right. What do I mean by this? Well, if we cast our memories back to last year, there was that peaceful gathering of tourists on January 6th at the Capitol. Do you remember that, Tracy? In which they gathered around peacefully and took photos and expressed their desire to hang with Mike Pence for a while. Remember that?
To hang with Mike Pence.
With Mike Pence. And then there's been, I'm joking here, but it's about to get dark. I'm sorry about that. There's been any number of mass shootings in the United States since that time, perpetrated by assailants whom we have later learned posted manifestos rooting their actions in right-wing rhetoric and their belief in a whole range of crazy things, everything from immigrants are coming to displace them and take away their jobs to America is going to be taken out of the hands of its rightful inheritors, white people, and on and on and on. So clearly we see incident after incident of violence tied to authoritarian rhetoric and language, and this is not an accident, however much these people tie themselves into knots trying to pretend otherwise. And as I mentioned, after the assault on Paul Pelosi, we've seen every possible permutation of that, including from the brand new owner of Twitter, Mr. Elon Musk, who tweeted the same conspiracy theory I alluded to earlier, that the assailant was a bearded nudist from Berkeley. He quickly deleted that tweet. But that opens up a whole new can of worms, Tracy. The fact that the world's richest man is now in control of, while not the largest social media platform, one with the most influence amongst reporters and elected officials. So not a recipe for good times.
Not at all. And especially because you know what side he leans on, right? He's, of course, because he's a corporate mogul and a multi-billionaire, he has ties to the far right as well, who will do whatever they can policy-wise to ensure that he keeps his money. And so we see this over and over again, very ultra-rich people in cahoots with the far right, because those are the people who want to maintain the status quo, who will do things like Bolsonaro, which is, you know, deforest the Amazon to extract it for resources, right? We know that people like Elon Musk are very much interested in extracting resources from everywhere, including the, you know, the Milky Way. There's a tie there that we have to be aware of, too. And, of course, the timing for Elon Musk takeover with, you know, kind of on the heels of the midterm elections also allows for media manipulation, manipulation of people on social media. We all know that that has been happening since before the 2016 election. And it continues to happen with bots and trolls amplifying certain kinds of messaging. And so we all need to be very aware of what's going on and take steps to fight back and push back upon that.
In one of the right-wing commentaries on the assault on Paul Pelosi was that the assailant arrived at the house naked and that Paul Pelosi himself answered the door naked, and this was more of a lover spat than anything else. And this is the sort of things that the right traffics in. And they have conditioned their base to believe these sorts of things. And when you're already of a mind to believe this sort of thing, it's a very short journey, Tracy, to, okay, well, you know, I'm going to pick up a weapon and I'm going to go after a prominent leftist, a prominent Democrat. Because, you know, that's what these people whom I respect and listen to all the time are suggesting to me that I do. And it doesn't take a whole lot to connect those dots.
It's not a lot at all, right? Because, of course, if the person who owns Twitter is also, you know, participating in that disinformation campaign, then you have people, of course, who will pick up that story and run with it and will not see in that, you know, kind of analysis of stochastic terror what's actually happening, right? And of course, right, and I please don't call today because I don't have any energy for that. But, you know, we have even callers who are, you know, people who present themselves as people on the far left who every chance they get will, you know, demonize Nancy Pelosi. And once again, with that kind of horseshoe theory that I've brought up before, right, you get so far to the left, you're touching the right and kind of doing a footsie with the right. And so these same messaging, they're happening on the left as well. People who demonize Nancy Pelosi, and at this point it's spilled over into her home and, you know, potentially caused, you know, considerable harm to her husband. It's scary stuff.
Yeah, considerable harm. And let's call this what it is. This was an assassination attempt. Had Speaker Pelosi been there, this man would have attempted to assassinate the Speaker of the House of the United States. So far, I really, I haven't seen it described in those terms in the media, but I really hope we I really hope we start talking about it that way, because that's what this was. That's what this was. Now, I got to jump in here with a couple of things. Engineer Sonia is whispering in my ear some messages. Here's a little glimpse behind the veil for you listeners. Engineer Sonia perches on my shoulder and whispers things in my ear. She's both the angel and the devil on that shoulder. That's what it's like in my head. While we're doing this program, I have a conversation with Tracy, with our callers, and with the little angel slash devil on my shoulder, who says, but people wrote and drew with chalk on the sidewalk outside Brett Kavanaugh's house. So, you know, both sides are doing this sort of thing. Right. Exactly. That's exactly equivalent. Chalk messages on the sidewalk are just like caving in someone's skull with a hammer. Exactly.
Or, you know, ruin somebody's dinner, right? They showed up and were chanting things at Brett Kavanaugh's dinner. Like, give me a break, right? I mean, the false equivalency is the bane of my existence. And I really want folks to, like, step into the space of analyzing. Are you doing that? Is that your, you know, MO to be a contrarian and create these false narratives about, you know, who is equally bad as another? I mean, I feel like I'm on this program to help dispel that and to call attention to people who do it often, because it really is quite trifling.
It's true. And what's worse, this is what passes for journalism in the United States now. The pathological need for journalists to look for something, some sort of equivalence that they can put up there, right? So that they give the appearance of being balanced and even-handed, right? When some sort of, really, an objective evaluation of the truth would lead journalists to say, wow, this sort of thing is far more prevalent on the right than it is on the left, and it's really vastly more likely to end up in violence on the right than it is on the left. But that's not what we get from mainstream journalism, is it? We get, oh, both sides. Oh, chalk on the sidewalk. It's frustrating. You're right. False equivalences, Tracy, are the bane of our existence. And we're going to do what we can to push back on them on this program. Engineer Sonia goes on to note, and this is very important, the Pelosi's control hundreds of millions of dollars in real estate. Their vested interests run directly counter to the majority of working people. That is absolutely true. And I think that's why we can, with a great degree of accuracy, point to Nancy Pelosi as an obstruction in the way of legislation that would benefit the broad working classes. Now, that said, we have to acknowledge the fact that the House of Representatives that she led during the administration of the former guy passed legislation so sweeping as to delight every dark corner of a progressive heart. And also under the administration of the present guy. So, yes, we can criticize her on the grounds that she is incredibly wealthy and that legislation enacted under her watch has helped to benefit the incredibly wealthy class. But she also has been willing to shepherd these things forward. So we need to acknowledge that. What do I mean by way of advancing the interests of the ruling class? Well, a few months ago, the question came up as to whether Congress should ban the trading of securities, stocks, and bonds among its members, which, yes, clearly a good idea. Yes, can't trade stocks and bonds if you are representing your district in the Congress of the United States, because the potential for corruption is just too high. Did Nancy Pelosi allow that to happen? No. She quite publicly denounced it and said they were going to make no changes to that rule. And is it a coincidence that her husband, who's now in the hospital, is a very, very wealthy man who has made his money as an investment banker? That is very true. And also as a real estate investor, as Engineer Sony points out. So incredibly mixed bag with Nancy Pelosi. But in any event, she did not deserve an assassination attempt, nor did her husband deserve to be the victim of that attempt. But that's where we are because of the barrage of violent rhetoric coming out of the right wing in the United States, Tracy.
Yeah, absolutely. And so fast forward to today in Brazil, what's so crazy is, you know, there are blockades. At least 25 flights have been canceled. People are not being able to leave the country. And what some folks are anticipating is, in lieu of a concession from Bolsonaro, there will be likely an attempt to deny the election, to use the power that currently exists in the hands of Bolsonaro to create something like a coup, right? And so we're talking about January 6th, you were just saying, right? Who knows what this will play out like in Brazil, but we need to be paying good attention to it. From the New York Times, they did a piece on a theory of why the far right is thriving across the globe. And so Pippa Norris, who's a social scientist, a political scientist, you know, has been really looking at this trend. And what she explains it as is a cultural backlash, so a silent revolution in cultural values. And what's interesting about that is, right, the cultural values that, you know, I am espousing are the cultural values of building communities of care, taking care of people, you know, defunding police and structures that don't create any investment in actual humans, but actually creates more harm in society, right? Are these the cultural values that are getting pushed back upon? Absolutely, right? Because when we think about just the global economy, the global economy is ran by several, you know, very rich people, and the rest of us just kind of have to fall in line. And if there's a recognition on a global scale that is no longer going to be accepted, right, then there is a cultural revolution that sweeps across the whole globe. And so the fight against that is this kind of uprise of authoritarianism that we're seeing. And it's really important that, you know, as we talk about, you know, American culture and how the culture wars narrative, picking, you know, scapegoats, pointing out people, whether that's anti-Semitism, transphobia, anti-blackness, whatever it is, right? These are all layered on top of each other. But they are not in alignment with a society that cares for everyone. And when we have a society that cares for everyone, we have to pay money that costs. And so then we have to tax people. And who do we tax? Not right now, but, you know, in this kind of cultural revolution, we tax the people who have the most resources. Of course, the people who have the most resources do not want that to happen because it will diminish their resources over time. And so there is an alignment there that I want to continue naming and putting some framework around. And I think about even the people who are backing Bolsonaro, right? Tucker Carlson, Steve Bannon, some of these very far-right supporters in the United States have been, you know, using their platforms to do think pieces on why Bolsonaro should continue being the president. And of course, Lula came back into power and has won this election because he stood firm on climate and combating climate change in Brazil. And so we know, you know, the impact the Amazon has on the ecosystem of the world, and, you know, kind of arose into that space and has won this election based on even that cultural value, which is also a threat to very wealthy and very much willing to exploit the earth and every person on the earth for their own capital interest.
Yeah, that's spot on. And that's the hidden hand played by right-wing autocrats, isn't it? They rise to power by saying to the people, you know, look at what has become of you. I have the answer. We are true citizens of whatever nation we happen to be in. You know, and only a leader who respects that can lead you up out of where you are. We are strong together, blah, blah, blah. The same, the appeal to nationalism, the appeal to race, the appeal to a central core culture, the creation of an in-group waging a noble battle against an out-group who is trying to come in and take everything away. The same pattern fits in all of these different places. And the hidden hand behind that is the enrichment of the strong man and the people attached to him and the international corporations who then have a free hand to do business in these various countries, including massive resource extraction, as you were just talking about, Tracy. So that's the hidden hand of right-wing authoritarianism. And it is incredibly seductive to many people in many places for the reasons we are talking about. But the interesting thing is that the leftward response that we're seeing in Central America and South America now is a reaction to the same set of conditions, except people have decided to go in a more hopeful, in a more constructive, in a more communal direction. So it's going to be very fascinating to see how those two choices, those two sets of choices, pan out. Not only because we're looking, ultimately, leftists are, for a more unified, cleaner, more sustainable, and just planet. Not just for that reason, but because here in the United States, we're facing the same set of choices for the same set of reasons. And we have managed so far to keep the right-wing advance at bay, just barely. I mean, we call that peaceful tourist gathering a couple Januaries ago that I mentioned. We've managed to keep that at bay. But this election is going to go a great deal of distance towards determining which of those two routes we are going to take. That's just one of the reasons we're telling you it's important to pay attention to these things. It's important to participate, not only in terms of casting your ballot, but in terms of trying to sway public opinion to the extent that you're able, to convince members of your family, your friends, to donate to campaigns elsewhere who need the support. All of these things we can do, and all of these things we must do, because that is the precipice at which we now sit. That was kind of grandiose, Tracy. Maybe you can bring us down to earth again.
Well, I just want to, you know, kind of shift the conversation to Lula and how he won. Of course, you know, he showed up as the climate person, and, you know, used his campaign to not only kind of amplify information about the biodiversity of the Amazon, how much impact protecting the Amazon would, you know, would do for the country. And, you know, upon his, you know, winning speech, he said Brazil is ready to resume its leading role in the fight against the climate crisis. He said, we will prove once again that it's possible to generate wealth without destroying the environment. And so, you know, these kind of messages, right, and I think about the campaign of Governor Jay Inslee of Washington when he was running for president against Trump in the early primaries, and his own messaging about, you know, what he was willing to do to protect the environment, right? And of course, he did not, you know, he did not thrive in that space, but it's like, how many of us would want someone like that to thrive and would actually put our resources and support behind a candidate who literally their main platform was the climate? And, you know, of course, for me, I'm always about civil rights and equity and inclusion and all of the things that matter for actual humans. But once again, right, if we don't have a habitable climate, then none of that matters anyway. And so, you know, what does it look like to have a similar kind of messaging here? And thinking about, you know, what's at stake in the 2024 election, I think trying to make some connections there is important. So, you know, when Lula was in office before, he took office in 2003, he enacted policies that reduced deforestation practices by 80%. And, of course, the lowest pace of deforestation was recorded 2 years after he was made to step down in 2010. But when Mr. Bolsonaro assumed office in 2019, he, of course, slashed funding for environmental protection agencies. He made fines and, you know, accountability for environmental disasters. He weakened all of that and encouraged his supporters to continue mining illegally. And so, of course, those are the people who have benefited from his leadership, and they are also likely to be involved in the coup, if there is a coup. So we've got to watch that space.
503-231-8187 is the number to call. I'm joining today's conversation. I'm very interested to hear what's on your mind vis-a-vis the goings-on elsewhere in the world and how they relate to what's happening here at home. 503-231-8187. Let's turn back to Twitter for a moment, Tracy, shall we?
Yeah.
This is a fascinating subject to me. So Elon Musk, we've been touching on this saga on this program for a while. Elon Musk, the world's richest man, flirted with buying Twitter several months ago, then decided he wanted to back out of the transaction because he realized he was going to dramatically overpay for what he was buying. But at that point, the board of directors of Twitter realized he was trying to back out and sued and wouldn't let him back out because they knew they would never be able to find another buyer who would be so stupid as to pay so much more for the company than what it was actually worth. So they successfully took Mr. Musk to court, and Mr. Musk, realizing he was going to lose that court battle, decided to go ahead with the purchase of Twitter at its vastly overvalued price tag, which he did. He now owns the place. And this is only anecdotal evidence from my perspective as a user of Twitter. But Tracy, it seemed very much to me that the trolls were out in force after Musk completed his acquisition of Twitter and were very much sort of testing the fences like the Raptors in Jurassic Park to see exactly what they could get away with, the whole time trumpeting the triumph and the return of free speech to the internet. Because now they could tweet all the racist stuff that's banging around in their skull. Did you experience something similar?
Well, what I noticed, and someone brought this to my attention that's in my, you know, kind of group chat, is that the number one word that was trending on Twitter the day that the acquisition was completed was the N-word.
Hey.
So that tells you everything you need to know. like it unleashed, you know, the swamp, and people were, of course, being able to just say whatever they want. And what I expect and anticipate is that will continue, right? Because, of course, in this takeover of Twitter, Trump has summarily, you know, fired all of the top executives. They're all people of color that he fired. I think maybe a few other people are not, but the top executives, he only fired the people of color, which is also telling. And one of those people, a woman executive, was the person who made the decision to finally, after so many Twitter violations of terms of service, you know, finally suspended the former guy for good. So there's a connection there, of course. And, you know, what I think is anticipated is that there will be less and less protections for actual individuals and less holding people accountable to the terms of service, if not just getting rid of the terms of service altogether. And he posted something to the point of free speech and wanting Twitter to be free. He posted something, the bird is now free or something like that, which of course to me indicates, yeah, free to harm people, free to say whatever you want. And once again, right, free speech is only free if you're not impacted, if you are not harmed by that speech. Free speech is very often not free for the people who are harmed.
That's true. It is often not free for the people who are harmed. That's absolutely correct. And there's some interesting dynamics also at play here in Musk's acquisition of Twitter. Perhaps the foremost being that it is not a very profitable business. In fact, in only 2 years of its existence, has it managed to actually turn a profit. One of the reasons is that its architecture, the way it's set up, the way Twitter works, is not as conducive to the sort of targeted advertising that made Facebook such a juicy prize for advertisers. It doesn't work in quite the same way. So it has difficulty consistently bringing in revenue. And so this is the asset that Musk overpaid so dramatically for. The other factor that's happening right now, which is I find fascinating, is that if you use Twitter at all, you know that you'll come across people who have little blue check marks by their name. The blue checks, they are colloquially called. What is a blue check? It is a symbol of verification that usually appears next to the name of a rich and or famous user of Twitter. The verification tells everybody else, yeah, that this is in fact Mitch McConnell, or it is in fact Bill O'Reilly, or Tom Cruise, or whoever it is who's using Twitter, or whoever's using that account and tweeting for Bill O'Reilly or for Tom Cruise or whoever. The blue check mark, it's everywhere. It is an indicator of authenticity, as I mentioned, but it's also become an indicator of status, right? You know, use Twitter, somebody with a blue check is tweeting something. Ooh, that means a whole bunch of people, first of all, are going to see it, and that because of the way human beings treat people with status, perceived or actual, they're going to talk about it. So one of the things that Musk has floated as he's trying to turn a profit from this big sluggish monster that he purchased, it's he's talking about maybe making people who have a blue check mark have to pay a monthly fee to maintain it. So we've been able to watch indignant celebrities splutter about how dare Elon suggest that I have to pay $20 a month for my blue check mark. Damn it. So that's been entertaining at the very least. But how this all plays out may sound trivial, right? It's a social media platform. Who cares? Who cares? But social media is how people in modern America communicate with each other to an enormous, enormous scale. It doesn't encompass everybody, of course, but a whole lot of people are both getting and sharing information by way of the various social media platforms on which they participate. Twitter is not a very big one in terms of volume, but as I said earlier, it has an outsized influence in the culture because it is the preferred platform of politicians, of journalists, and of famous people. So with that trifecta, that makes Twitter something that, you know, he might want to acquire if you're Elon Musk. But now he's got it. It doesn't make money, and he's trying to figure out what to do with it. This may have a tangible impact on political discourse in the country. It really remains to be seen.
Many of the people who have those blue checks are journalists, are political commentators, are you know, political scientists, economists, people who have a platform on Twitter and who are sharing information. If they decide to either leave Twitter or not pay for the check marks, right? The blue checks, of course, are of course an indicator of some kind of status, but they're also a protection against people who will make bot accounts and name them after well-known journalists, you know, people who are in the sphere, you know, sharing information. And so it's really easy to, you know, copycat a person and spew a whole bunch of nonsense. So also, right, it ramps up the possibility for disinformation, as well as those blue checkmark people deciding they don't want to be on Twitter anymore, going somewhere else. And we're left with True Social, right? Like, where a whole bunch of right-wing people and bots and nonsense, you know, a la, you know, Reddit or, you know, some other kind of platform where 4chan is what people are saying, where people just can say whatever they want and have no repercussions or accountability. That's harmful. And if you remember in the 2020 election cycle, Twitter started putting a disclaimer on certain tweets that potentially were disinformation or misinformation. Haven't seen that once. I haven't seen that once. And what I would you know, probably assume is that that is not something that Elon Musk will bring back, and that is not something that will be done in content moderation either, under Elon Musk. And that's very scary, because if we're talking about, you know, a public square, a place where you can share ideas and information, and there's no content moderation, what we have is a populace that is completely dumbed down and likely running with conspiracy theories, misinformation, disinformation, and also causing a ton of harm. Because, right, if we're all not knowing what the truth is, we cannot create an effective direction for change.
Are you suggesting, Tracy, that Elon Musk, who's values were forged as a young man whose family owned an emerald mine in apartheid South Africa, are you suggesting that Twitter under his stewardship might descend into racist discourse? Come on.
I mean, I'm pretty sure. Yes, that's what I'm saying. That is what I'm saying. And not just racist, right? I mean, it could be, of course, Gamergate, you know, 3.0, mm-hmm. right? Where it's misogyny and incel stuff, or it's, you know, anti-Semitism, or anti, you know, Muslim sentiments, right? There's all kinds of ways that harmful disinformation can spill out and actually create violence, and real life peril for individuals and groups. And so this is what I'm really nervous about, right? And, you know, without content moderation, right? And I think about places like 4chan, 8chan, where there was no content moderation. What you see is some of the worst impulses of people, whether that's, you know, mass shootings or, you know, displays of you know, rape fantasies, or I mean, just some of the stuff that exists on those platforms. If it was on a platform like Twitter, where, you know, pretty much everyone can see it, it has real negative impacts on the whole American culture. So,
QAnon, we would not have QAnon if not for boards like 4chan and 8chan.
Exactly.
That's really true.
Exactly.
And the big unanswered question on the minds of most everybody who uses Twitter is, will Elon Musk allow Donald Trump back onto the platform? I suspect the answer to that question is yes, that we will, in the not too distant future, see the return of Donald Trump to his favorite place on the internet, Twitter. Now, we've talked before on this program what a distorting and destabilizing impact he was able to have there, as he would over the course of the days, who's supposed to be presidenting was instead tweeting, incredibly disruptive, incredibly inflammatory, and I suspect incredibly gratifying to his ego. I read accounts from insiders in the Trump administration saying that among the things that made him the most angry, almost as angry as losing the election, was the fact that he was kicked off Twitter.
Well, friends, we seem to have encountered another of our famed and oh-so-enjoyable technical weirdnesses. Please stay tuned as we work to get Abe and Tracy back into the mix. Stay tuned. And we are back. Take it, kids.
All right. We are back. Technical difficulties. Apologies for that this morning. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Let's go to Francis. Good morning, Francis.
Hi. I am continuing to harp on the fact that corporations are not people, although they've been given people status in our laws. and they're kind of running things rather than the people. And that trial in New York right now is evidence of the fact. They're trying the Trump Corporation, not the people in it. And the corporation can't go to jail, so it'll be fine. I wish that people that are in jail now for similar charges could file an appeal to say they want the same treatment. If corporations are people, they should be able to go to prison. They can't, so they're not people. So people in prison for similar charges should say, hey, I'll gladly take a fine. Let me out of prison. Anyway, I wanted to talk about this election denial that's going on. There's a whole several regular people being tried now for sedition, conspiracy, and the premise, the fundamental pillar of that sedition is the election denial. So I don't understand how all these people can run for office with their platform being the election denial. To me, they're all participating in seditious conspiracy, and they all should be arrested. Does that make sense at all?
Oh, well, yeah. On a certain level, it does. Yeah.
On a what?
On one level, it does. Yeah. On
well,
the
we're
other,
a country of laws,
from a different way.
Supposedly.
Go ahead and say that again,
way,
please.
How would it be viewed a different way?
Well, we have very broad protections of free speech in this country,
exactly.
Which extends to the right to say something that isn't true.
To continue participating in a seditious conspiracy?
No, I don't think it extends to the right to continue participating in a seditious conspiracy. I think it would be a struggle for you to prove a seditious conspiracy by pointing at candidates who are running and denying the election. I think that would be a pretty heavy lift, legally speaking.
However,
I'm with you.
Of their insurrection was the election denial. So, I don't know. I wish somebody could look into that further. I may do that. Anyway, I appreciate you guys. Thank you.
Thank you, Francis. Francis's comments, Tracy, I think they beg a larger question. There's been a lot of mockery made of the UK's political system recently as they have been going through prime ministers left and right, Liz Truss being the most recent and the shortest serving prime minister in the history of the UK. But I think what we're failing to see, those of us here in the United States who have been mocking that, is that's evidence of a system over there that is working, right? There's widespread perception of misrule. Then the system demands that a prime minister step down, which is what happened in the United States. Here, where there's widespread evidence of misrule, the people espousing it, they hang on to power. There's no question of them stepping down. And in fact, as Francis noticed, they can just go out and campaign on the very lie that calls their competence into question. So if there's a broken political system here, it's the one on this side of the Atlantic, not the other side of the Atlantic. 503-231-8187. Do you have any thoughts on that, Susan?
No, I mean, so like Carrie Lake in Arizona is one of the people who's already saying that she is probably not going to accept the results of the election unless she wins. I agree with Francis. That should be basically, you should have to assert yourself that you will accept the results of the election to be able to be even running. I don't think that's a huge thing that we should be asking folks. And it's really scary when we have several people in several states kind of echoing that. So it's not seditious yet, right? The yet is where it's a little wiggly. But I think that should be a disqualification, just like it should be a disqualification to, not know the basic, functions of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. We literally have dum-dums, excuse my language, running for office in places. And to me, that also is a huge a huge threat to democracy when we have people who are not smart enough, a la Herschel Walker, to be able to even articulate a policy position, an understanding of the function of government, and be able to get elected. Like, that is a bare minimum. And I think about, for most industries, any position that you could potentially have, there is a minimum requirement for that that does not exist for Congress, Senate, right? And it's frightening. That's frightening to me. In addition to, you know, saying out loud with your own mouth that you will not accept the results of a democratically held election. Very frightening.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, the extent to which ignorance prevails amongst the American electorate about how the most basic questions about government. What was the poll we talked about a few weeks ago where a majority, a slight majority, but a majority of Americans were not able to successfully identify the three branches of government? That is a big problem. That is a big problem. 503-231-8187. Let's go to Tawazi. Good morning. Are you with us?
Hey there.
Hey.
This is Tawazi. Hi. I just wanted to talk a little bit about Twitter because there's sort of different levels of free speech given to people on Twitter, right? Like,
no, I'm not familiar with this. Go ahead.
Like, I for instance, went to jail for one of my tweets. And the tweet that I made, or the series of tweets that I made, didn't violate any terms of service agreements, and they weren't a crime. But law enforcement was still able to construe my words in such a way that they would... you know, create a warrant. But other people use much more dangerous wordage and create much more harm for the community through, like, I don't know, the sorts of things the Proud Boys do, or even Ted Wheeler, that they stoke the flames of division by pitting us against each other, you know. It's a real crab pot situation on Twitter, and it's upheld by systems that are biased and treat people differently. So I just noticed your engineer today is Jacqueline Keeler, and I wouldn't have called if I had known they were going to be in the office today. I'm really sorry that you guys give that person a platform. I'm going to keep funding you guys the best
that I
can.
No, that's not, hang on. No. Hey, that's enough. I'm sorry. No, first of all, you have misnamed who our engineer is, and we are not going to give people a platform to trash volunteers at KBOO. So thank you for your call. 503-231-8187. That kind of took a turn, Tracy.
Yeah.
But listen, Tawazi, I'm really sorry you ended up in jail for something you tweeted. Clearly, that's not the way things should work. All right, let's go to Molly. Good morning, Molly. All right. Looks like we missed Molly. Well, we are coming up against the end of the show. There is an election here in the United States coming up. I hope that you all are going to participate. You all are going to cast a vote in that election. Fortunately, it's very, very easy to do so from here in Oregon, something for which I remain grateful each and every time election day rolls around. Tracy, I presume you are doing your duty?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's not a choice for me. It's a requirement. It is a prerequisite to be able to exist in this country for me is to use all of the power that I have been given, which is not much, but it's something to vote. And I do believe that every vote does count. And so hopefully if you're an Oregonian, you have already received your ballot, please take some time with it. Do your due diligence to figure out outside of that you know, potentially tragic voters pamphlet. Get the information that you need about your candidates and choose wisely and get those ballots turned in on time. It's your civic duty.
I couldn't have said it better myself. Also, although most of us appear to be behaving as if the coronavirus pandemic is in the rearview mirror, it is most assuredly not. It is still among us. Somebody I know had a repeat case just recently who had been vaxxed twice and boosted again. So it is still very possible to contract this disease. So still, live your lives, but take precautions when appropriate. And if it's time for your next booster, go out there and get it. Anything else to send us out today, Tracy?
No, I would just say, you know, of course, resist the temptation to cast your ballot against houseless people. For you know, criminal justice reform, please do. And of course, to continue taking care of yourselves and others. It's cold, it's rainy season. If you have the ability to take care of your neighbors who are unsheltered, please do so. It is just going to continue to get colder and wetter. And we have also a responsibility as a civilized society that if we have the ability and the means to take care of other people, that we should do so. And that's all.
That seems like a good place to leave things. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in today. Apologies for the technical difficulties. And as always, we are grateful for your contributions to the dialogue on this program. And whether or not you agree with us, wherever you may land on the political spectrum, I hope that we have this in common. The whole thing falls apart if you don't participate. So get out there, cast your vote. For Tracy Simmons, my name is Abe Proctor. This has been Too Much Information on KBOO 90.7 FM. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Here at KBOO, we honor the indigenous people whose traditional and ancestral homelands we stand on. The Multnomah, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Tomwa.